Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. The birth control pill is considered one of the most important inventions of the 20th century. When it was approved about 50 years ago by the Food and Drug Administration, it ushered in a controversial new era in which women and families can choose when and if they want to have children. You may not know that the pill was created in Massachusetts due to the ardent efforts of four people, including a researcher ousted from Harvard in the 1930s, a Catholic Boston doctor, an MIT-trained millionaire, and an avowed feminist. Their efforts are detailed in a new book by journalist and author Jonathan Eig called The Birth of the Pill: How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Jonathan spoke with us in our studio in October, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation today.
I think a lot of people today take it for granted just how different women's lives were before the pill, when there really was no reliable form of contraception, and when the forms that were available were really all controlled by men. Not just the condom, which is, you know, controlled by men during the act of sex, but to get a diaphragm, to get an IUD, you had to get a doctor's help in that process. So women really needed something of their own. And because they didn't have that control over their own reproduction, they had sometimes, you know, 7, 8, 9 kids. When they didn't want to keep having them, the kids kept coming. And that, of course, limited the things they could do with their lives. It affected their health. They, you know, having that many children would wear women out. Taking care of that many children would wear women out. And the opportunities to go to college, to start careers, were slim to none for many people.
I know the view of some people who really promoted the pill were that essentially women were in a kind of sexual servitude, that it was sort of like this exhausting, continuous cycle of childbearing that was inevitable and couldn't be stopped.
That's right. Pretty much for as long as there have been humans on this earth, women were in this role that was their job, to be the vessel, to carry these children. And womanhood equaled motherhood. There was nothing else for many women.
And remind us, you cover some of the ways that women would try to prevent contraception. Have lemons used as cervical caps, elephant dung as a plug. I mean, you talk about the lengths to which people went to try to make sure they didn't have children.
For as long as people have been making babies, they've been trying not to. And some of the ways they came up with were not only bizarre, they were dangerous. Many women ended up suffering severe injuries because they tried to terminate their pregnancies. And of course, you know, abortions were illegal and very dangerous in the early part of the 20th century.
So your book tackles four key people who played a role in the pill coming to be. Probably the best known is Margaret Sanger, you know, the woman who founded the precursor to Planned Parenthood. Tell us what she wanted to do and what motivated her.
Well, she began as a nurse in the tenements of New York City in the 19-teens and saw how women were suffering. She saw her own mother die from having given birth to so many children. And she believed that there ought to be a way for women to get better help on birth control, to get better education at least. And she also really thought that they should be allowed to enjoy sex and that it was something worth fighting for simply for the pleasure as well. So she had this dream that she talked about for decades, that there ought to be a way for women to turn on and off their reproductive systems. That she talked about it, the magical tablet, she called it. But it was fantasy stuff. Everybody she talked to about this said, keep dreaming. It'll never happen.
The magical tablet is easy to ingest as aspirin, right?
That's right. That's what she said. And she thought it had to be something women could do on their own. They could hide from men if necessary. They could keep it in their purses and not tell their spouses or their partners that they were taking this. And that when they stopped taking it, they needed to be able to get pregnant again. This was her dream. She talked about it for decades and tried to recruit scientists to work on such a thing, but nobody would go near it. It was dangerous. It was controversial. Birth control was illegal in most of the country. There were still federal laws on the books making it illegal even to disseminate information about birth control.
That's a key point. People need to remember that it wasn't just frowned upon sort of morally. It was illegal. It took the Supreme Court to make it possible.
That's right. Not till, you know, 5 years after the pill was approved by the FDA. So the pill was approved before the Supreme Court ruled that contraception was a right that women had. So Sanger, of course, got no interest. Doctors, scientists all told her there was no chance. No drug company would ever make such a thing. The government would never license such a thing. So why? Why bother trying?
And you mentioned she had tried to recruit scientists. Ultimately did. She found scientist Gregory Goodwin Pincus, a biologist, I believe. Although I think your book notes that it's hard to tell, really, whether he was motivated for the same reasons she was, sort of for the women's rights, in a sense, versus his desire for an unorthodox challenge, basically.
Pincus was at first attracted to the challenge. He was not a feminist. He did not come at this with the view of changing the world. He came at this because it was a challenge, and the fact that no other scientist would take it on really piqued his interest. He was a supremely confident man, believed in his own genius, but he'd been fired from Harvard and couldn't get a job anywhere else in the country. He was considered too toxic.
What did he do that got him fired at Harvard?
In vitro fertilization. In the 1930s, and the press picked up on it and compared him to Frankenstein. He said he was trying to create babies in labs and test tubes, and that's exactly what he was trying to do, but it didn't go over that well in the 1930s. He was also Jewish at a time of a lot of anti-Semitism at Harvard. So he was cut loose, unemployable, started his own laboratory in Worcester, literally went door to door in Worcester asking people to contribute money so that we could have our own scientific institution right here in Worcester.
This was the Worcester Foundation for Experimental Biology?
That's right. Not the snappiest name.
What did he want to do there exactly?
He wanted a chance to research, to do whatever, you know, he deemed important. Again, it wasn't the birth control pill that was motivating him. It was biological research. And this was the dawn of the age of hormones. He was very interested in man's understanding of hormones and how they could control the body. And he believed that great mysteries were going to be unlocked.
And it was just by chance, really, at a dinner party that he and Margaret Sanger came across each other?
Well, they'd been connected. Catherine McCormick, who ended up funding a lot of the birth control research,
this
almost
is the
all of it.
The money woman, basically, in this story.
She's the woman with the checkbook. She knew of Pincus's work because Pincus had done work in an attempt to cure schizophrenia, and her husband had suffered from schizophrenia. So Catherine McCormick, told Sanger about Pincus, said, "This is a guy you ought to meet." They met, and immediately when Sanger presented her problem and said she dreamed of this pill, Pincus said, "Oh, I can do that."
As you said, very confident man.
Yeah.
You also mentioned a third character in your book, and that was Catherine McCormick. As we said, she was essentially the money behind the operation. And how she came about that money is an interesting story in itself.
Right. She was born into privilege, but she got even richer when she married Stanley McCormick, the heir to the Chicago McCormick fortune, the International Harvester fortune earned from the invention of the Reaper. And Stanley McCormick was severely mentally ill, institutionalized most of his life. And when he finally died and left all this money to Catherine, she decided that she wanted to take that money and go back to working with Margaret Sanger, who she'd known early in her life, and wanted to invest everything she could in the creation of this birth control
pill.
And
it was a quite massive amount of money for the time that she had been left by her late husband.
Yeah, something like $375 million. And
this is where she decided she wanted her philanthropy to go.
This was her big cause.
Now, there's another doctor who is a part of this story. This is Dr. Rock. Tell us about character number four in your book.
Dr. John Rock brings respectability to this band of misfits. He's a Harvard gynecologist, one of the most respected OBGYNs in the country. In the 1950s in particular, women are feeling like if they can't have babies, it's a terrible problem because fertility rates are soaring in the country. So he's got one of the largest practices for infertility in the country, in addition to delivering babies and helping women with their pregnancies. As a result of this, he really becomes passionate about women's rights and sees the importance of women being able to have sex for pleasure, that it's important to a family. It's also important for them not to be able to have babies every time they have sex. And as a result of that, even though he's Catholic and attends Mass every day, he decides that the church is wrong on this issue and that he's willing to work. He's willing to team up with these other individuals to try to see if they can come up with this birth control
pill.
And
I believe you're right that he hoped the church would come around one day, but of course didn't. But he pushed ahead with his work anyway.
That's right. In fact, he went to Rome and lobbied the Vatican and tried to convince them that this was an important moment, that they had a chance here to view this pill as a natural form of birth control and in line with the rhythm method, and that they ought to embrace it. And the Vatican came close to agreeing with him, but ultimately, of course, did not.
I'm talking here on Radio Boston with Jonathan Eig. He's the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Jonathan, you've laid out these four characters. I think, as you said, you call them a band of rebellious misfits. They came up with the science. They found a way to stop ovulation. When it gets to the testing of the pill, things get a little unsavory. In fact, it's unclear whether, had this been today, the standards we have for medical research would have allowed this to go forward. Tell us about some of the dubious part of this.
The standards today would definitely have stopped this thing cold. They were pushing the limits of by today's ethical standards. At the time, they were pretty much well within the norms. But to begin with, they couldn't test this thing in the United States because birth control was illegal. So they didn't call it birth control. They began by taking some of Dr. Rock's patients who were seeking help with infertility and gave them the birth control pill and said, "This is going to make you really infertile for a little while. This is going to really shut down your reproductive system, and maybe it'll give your system a rest. And when you come off of this new medicine, you'll get pregnant. Who knows? It's worth a try. But that was an important test because they were able to give this at that point, it was still an injection. They were able to give this injection to women and see that it really did shut down their ovulation and see that it didn't cause them any harm except for some mild nausea and some headaches and some dizziness. But the male doctors were fine with ignoring all that. They plowed ahead. Then they tested it in some mental health centers, insane asylums.
Right. This is where it gets quite is where we really start
where
to get
there's
dicey.
There's no consent. Women
right,
are
these
just,
were not always willing test subjects.
No, the doctors I talked to who worked there at the time told me they would just walk up to women and say, "Hey, Jane, I've got a shot for you today." And nobody ever asked what it was. No forms were signed. But even then, they'd only tested it on, you know, a handful of women, dozens, and they needed hundreds, if not thousands. I mean, think about it. This is the first pill that you're going in the world that you're going to give to healthy people every day.
And this is where some tweaking of the data comes in.
Yeah, it got really interesting. They eventually found a bigger audience, a bigger supply of women in Puerto Rico, in the slums of San Juan, where women were desperate for birth control. The population there was soaring. The average woman in San Juan at the time had 6.8 children. So when these American doctors show up with a new form of birth control pill, there was no questions asked. Nobody asked whether it had already been approved by the FDA or not. They were lining up at the clinics. But even then, they still only managed to get 132 women to take the pill for 6 months in a row, which is pretty sketchy when you think about taking it to the FDA and saying, we want approval for this pill, but only 132 women have taken it so far.
And again, because those women sort of give up on the process after a while?
Yeah, it was difficult. You know, there was a lot of complaints of nausea. The doses were much, much too high. They were giving them 10 milligrams of this progesterone and estrogen combination, and that turned out to be much higher than was necessary. But the scientists, Pincus and Rock, were mostly concerned with absolutely shutting down pregnancy. If they could safely report that no one got pregnant, they considered their drug effective, and they thought the FDA would approve it. The FDA wasn't that concerned with side effects back in those days.
And ultimately, they got their approval.
Yeah, and again, they were a little sneaky about it. First of all, instead of saying they only had 130 women, they said they had something like 13,000 menstrual cycles. So they fudged those numbers. And then they didn't ask for approval as birth control. They went to the FDA and asked for approval for a pill that would regulate women's cycles. So women who had irregular cycles could take this pill and become more regular. And it was very clever because the threshold for approval was much lower for something like that. It didn't seem as controversial. And these pills came with a warning on the bottle that said pregnancy will not occur while taking this pill. And that became great advertising because women realized that if they took this, they wouldn't get pregnant. And they began flocking to their doctor's offices saying, I need that pill for the irregular cycle.
And it was quickly embraced, and it really did change what it meant to be a woman. And of course, there are many societal implications to that. I mean, as you've written about, it raises questions about, I mean, we saw, for example, more women going to business school and law school. We also saw, you know, more abortions. People wonder if there's a connection between single parenthood, divorce. So in terms of the what people view as the negative consequences of the pill's arrival, what did you consider sort of the biggest societal change it brought about?
Well, almost overnight, you start to see these societal changes. You see women staying in school longer. You see them delaying the decision to get married and have children until they're a little bit older. There are some negative consequences as well. You know, there's more promiscuity. There's more premarital sex. You can argue that it helps contribute to the, you know, the sliding morals that we see during the sexual revolution. But overall, the effects both on health and on women's abilities to earn are just tremendous. And you can't overlook that issue of the health, because when women have fewer unplanned pregnancies, you get far fewer complications, you get far fewer deaths of infants, far fewer maternal deaths, and far fewer abortions. So the health implications are often overlooked as we talk about the societal implications.
Although I'm trying to remember whether this was mentioned in your book or in one of the reviews of your book, but is that someone said there's an argument to be made that ultimately has the pill helped more affluent women more than poorer women. I'm wondering where you stand on that view.
Well, that was one of the concerns. Sanger and the others really thought that this would be something that would affect the population growth, that it would control the population growth and help us conserve resources. And it hasn't worked so well. You see, obviously, the population in the world continues to soar. And the pill is not the perfect form of birth control, especially in poor developing countries, because it requires a doctor's prescription so far in most places. And it's something you have to remember to take every day. And if you slip up or if you run out and you can't get your prescription refilled, it's not ideal. So I think the search is still on for a better form of birth control. It has proven more effective for women of means than it has for women in developing countries.
Jonathan, I understand there's an interesting story about what gave you the idea to write about this. It has to do with your rabbi. Can you tell us what planted the idea?
Yeah, a couple of factors. But one was that my rabbi, 10, 12 years ago, gave a sermon where he talked about the birth control pill being perhaps the most important invention of the 20th century. And my initial reaction was, no way, baloney. It can't possibly be. But as I thought about it, and it sunk in, you think about all of these fundamental ways it changed not just women's lives, but it changed the institution of marriage. It changed courtship. It changed the way we get along. It changed women's position in society, their power. It probably did more for equality than any invention in the history of mankind. And then, of course, I also had my wife saying, you should write a book that women might be interested in reading for a change, because my other books were all sort of guy books.
You know, when I knew that I'd be speaking with the author of a book about the birth control pill, I feel a little self-chastened by this, but I assumed the author was going to be a woman. And then when I thought it was a man, that's when I thought to myself, now, why would I have thought that a woman would write this? Of course a man could write this. But do you think that being a male writer, you brought any particularly new perspective to this issue?
Well, I don't know. But I think being an outsider and not having obsessed about this and only perhaps seen birth control from a distance, and many men see it as at too great a distance. We let the women make these decisions and we don't talk about it very much. But I think that helped me see it from a distance and to see that this was a story of great characters pulling off something really remarkable, pulling off something that's nearly a miracle. And then from there, I got sucked into the issues, the ethics, the morals, and how it changed the world. I think that distance allowed me some objectivity, perhaps.
For an invention that did change the world as much as it did, why do you think most of these people, other than, say, Margaret Sanger, are so relatively unknown?
That's a great puzzle to me. I think, we know the names of the inventors of most of these key products that have affected our lives, and we don't know the story of the pill. And I think it's because, in part, that this was seen as a woman's thing, that it took a while for the world to recognize that this was a world-changing invention, not just something that women kept in their purses and kept quiet about.
Jonathan Eig is the author of the new book, The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you.
You whined me and dined me when I was your girl.
We'll go out on Loretta Lynn's 1975 song called The Pill. Its lyrics about a woman controlling her reproductive choices were considered risque at the time, so the song was banned by several country music stations. Here's some of what they didn't want their listeners to hear.
This old maternity dress I've got is going in the garbage. The clothes
stay with us. Coming up, the youngest senior TED Fellow, Berklee College of Music student Usman Reyaz. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.
For all those years since I've got the pill. I'm tired of all your crowing, how you and your hens play, while holding a couple in my arms and others on the way. This chicken's done tore up her nest, and I'm ready to make a deal. And you can't afford to turn it down, 'cause you know I've got the pill. This incubator is overused, because you've kept it filled. The feeling good comes easy now, since I've got the pill. It's getting dark, it's roosting time. Tonight's too good to be real. Oh, but daddy, don't you?